Hello and welcome to Together We Create, a podcast about collaborative social research. My name's Lili Gol Mohammadi, and I'm a collaborative researcher working across design, technology, and social research at UCL. In each episode, I'll be talking to an academic at UCL to find out more about how and why social researchers collaborate with researchers outside of their own discipline, and hearing about them and their research as we discuss the benefits and challenges of taking a multidisciplinary approach. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Aaron Parkhurst, an anthropologist who has studied and worked in the UK, the US, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman. He completed his MSc and PhD in medical anthropology at UCL. And before this, he studied and worked in molecular biology and genetics labs in the US. And he joined UCL in 2013, first as a researcher studying trust, risk, and uncertainty among economists, and he is currently an associate professor in medical anthropology. Aaron's work combines interests in science and genetics, cyborgs, the body and technology, and immigration to address the complex challenge of how we might live differently on Earth and beyond. So, Aaron, wow, that is quite a range there. Can you tell us a bit about the interests and events that have shaped your path to the researcher that you are today?
I think I started off as a young undergraduate student in Boston, in Massachusetts, at Brandeis University. And I worked for a NASA-funded laboratory funded by the Johnson Space Center. And they were planning this science for a manned mission to Mars, which is what it was originally funded for. I was studying as a young biologist and an anthropologist. But they were answering what I found later, many years later, that they were answering these really deep questions about mind and body connections and about how the body changes in different, radically different environments to what you might find on Earth, and how that has reciprocal changes in the way that people think, in the way that people move. And it also answers deep philosophical questions that sort of philosophers and social scientists have been asking for centuries about mind and body connections. So that's sort of what kicked it off. I worked there for 2-3 years while I was an undergraduate student and became interested in molecular biology and medicine. I shadowed a heart surgeon for 6 months as part of a work study program, and where the medicine was fascinating, and at the time I was considering becoming a surgeon myself, which in the end I decided I did not want to do. But those questions about the body in that space undergoing this, what it is actually a very traumatic event, raised some more really interesting questions about mind and body connections, about the nature of healing, about the body's relationship to an environment. So I took these sort of experiences with me and discovered medical anthropology almost by accident. I was bartending my way across Europe, a bit of a lost soul for a couple of years, trying to sort out what exactly I wanted to do with my life in my early 20s. And the bar I happened to work at was in Holborn, around the corner from here. And there were posters up for medical anthropology seminar series at UCL. They were held at the British Museum at the time. We didn't have the building that we're in now wasn't even built yet. I found these advertisements in Russell Square, where I used to go to read on my breaks. And I thought, oh, that looks really cool. And I went and I found it was this sort of brilliant mix that I didn't know existed between philosophy on mind and body and its connections to practical applications for clinical encounters, to the way that health and well-being are constructed in general around the world. It can combine genetics and molecular biology, and you can combine sort of philosophies of cognition, and you can bring them all together, and you've got this beautiful discipline. So I became hooked. I drank the Kool-Aid, and that was 17 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
And I never thought I'd be here 17 years later, but here I am.
Here you are. Yeah. And I heard you now run this series of talks. Sorry.
I do. In our department, we take turns now as senior staff of organizing and running these medical anthropology seminar series.
Wow.
So, yeah, I met my PhD my master's and then eventually my PhD supervisor at the British Museum. Mm-hmm. I was just there because they were free to attend. Gosh. So I came and crashed it and got to talk to him, drinks afterwards. And then he convinced me to apply. And then here I am.
Wow. I love the serendipity of that story. So you never know, people just keep going to things, keep wondering. It's not as aimless as you think. So I hear you've been a space geek since you were 5 years old. And as an undergraduate, you're an intern at the NASA Space Lab. And you now teach a module on extraterrestrial anthropology. So can you talk for a moment about why an anthropologist is interested in space?
For one, yes, I'm a self-described space geek. I had a picture of Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, sort of old promo photo of them, sort of American nationalist type of mm-hmm. thing at the time above my bed when I was a little kid. My parents would drive. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia originally, and we mm-hmm. would drive to Huntsville, Alabama Space Center, which was, it's like a 4-hour drive from Atlanta when I was a kid. And that was sort of what we got to do on birthdays. And then later, again, through a series of serendipities, I ended up at this this lab at Brandeis run by James Lackner and Paul Dizio, working with Shauna Kaplan, an amazing researcher, funded by Johnson Space Center, as I've mentioned. But I actually think that as amazing as that science is about sort of developing the frameworks for how we can live in outer space, mm-hmm. the things that we have to do to our body and minds in order to live well, not just to survive, but to thrive as we leave the planet. I actually genuinely believe that the good research in outer space living has direct translation to how we might live differently on Earth, to tell us something about constructs of health and well-being and the body across the planet.
We'll come to that now. You were awarded seed funding from UCL's Collaborative Social Science Domain for a project with a rather intriguing title, Off-World Living Analog Pilot Projects Determining Their Value for the Far and Near Future. So could you talk for a moment about the focus and aim of that project?
Yes, we were very grateful to the Collaborative Social Science Domain for that seed funding. I think the motivation behind it was that we wanted to think about how to live differently in outer space, and in doing so, as I mentioned before, meet these challenges of perhaps living differently here on Earth through rapid urbanization and modernization, but also ethical commitments to dealing with climate change, how we might live better while also living smaller in smaller spaces, taking up less space, living more communally. And I think having worked with architects and designers who are designing Mars and lunar habitats for NASA and for the European Space Agency, my colleagues and I work as consultants on some of these projects, that actually the design of, say, a lunar habitat or a Martian habitat to live well in these spaces in very harsh environments with very limited resources, actually, there's an awful lot of lessons that we can learn from designing those spaces from the ground up. And the thing is that space provides a context in which we have almost a tabula rasa. We've got this blank slate where we don't have to necessarily engage with conservative, orthodox, earthbound structures, those ones that we sort of hold on to dearly when we create built environments here. But also the ones we don't even know, because you live in this earthbound system and mm-hmm. you don't even know the biases and assumptions you have in living, because you can't see yourself from within the system. So space forces us to think differently. We have to. Gravity is different. Resources are different. The time delay just between communicating between Mars and Earth is 17 minutes. So you have to think everything differently. And because mm-hmm. you're forced to, you can create these sort of radical different ideas about built environments and habitats and how to live and even how to move your body in those spaces.
Yeah.
Exercise, everything. And it can only be done, we argued, through a multidisciplinary lens, which is what, you know, the motivation for turning to the Collaborative Social Science Domain was for. It can't be done by just an anthropologist or mm-hmm. a biologist or an architect from the Bartlett or an artist from the Slade. It has to be done in conversation, because we're looking at an entire human project. So that was the motivation in applying for this seed fund, and we got it. And so we held some events to try and tease out what might this future living look like.
Your project drew together a team who had a very broad expertise, why did it need that particular mix of researchers from anthropology, sustainable construction, architecture, and cardiovascular science?
I think this combo, first, it spread across four faculties, mm-hmm. between the Bartlett and social and historical sciences, risk and disaster reduction, and architecture. And I think it was just an awesome team because we had social science, we had medicine, we had people who are experts in the built environments and sustainability, and we had people who, you know, understood risks of living in harsh environments. And, you know, we had been in conversation about this now for a number of years, and I work on projects with these people in other capacities, and we thought, well, let's use this collaboration and just make it bigger. This seed mm-hmm. fund, what this seed fund was primarily used for was to build a community of interest of people who have a wide range of expertise. So we took these four faculties and used that as an excuse to get as many other faculties involved as we could.
Amazing.
We held these events in partnership with the British Interplanetary Society.
Wow.
Which is, yeah, in Vauxhall. They're really sort of neat society here in London that have shaped UK space industry for decades. And we had a call from microanalog projects.
Yeah, can I just quickly ask you about that term?
Yeah.
Because I've been reading around your work and it feels like you use that to mean several different things. So my understanding is, on the one hand, it refers to something that simulates a space mission in full on Earth. But I also get the sense of it as more than this, that it describes prototypes or models, but also a social science methodology for helping with the challenges of off-world living. Is that right?
Yes, there's a number of projects there. It is true that we often take the idea of the analog as an ethnographic project, mm-hmm. that it can mean an awful many things depending on the research and methodologies you want to engage with. For this particular project, we called it microanalogs. I'm not sure yet, still, if it's the absolute best term.
Yeah.
But it's the one that we came up with and that we engaged with. And that is, we weren't coming together to design an entire sort of lunar habitat,
uh-huh.
to model something, what would be an earthbound habitat, mm-hmm. based off of a lunar habitat. That is a massive project. This project was smaller in scope, but we still wanted people to contribute to this idea of what elements do we need to think about if we want to think about living differently off-world, and in turn think about living differently on Earth. And so when we invited people to these workshops, what we wanted was them to think of just some micro element,
uh-huh.
hence the micro and
okay.
micro analog.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what
yeah.
tiny piece could you contribute to? And so we had architects who were designing new stairwells based off 3D printing technology, say.
That was for Martian gravity, is that correct?
Yeah, for Martian.
And trampolines for Martian gravity.
Yes, and trampolines.
Yeah.
That was a research and awesome.
I really want to know about the trampolines.
There was, well, we had tried to think of what kind of exercise do uh-huh. you need to do? And on the International Space Station, astronauts have to exercise about 2.5 hours every day.
Ooh. Okay.
Or their bones decalcify, your body gets rid of what it doesn't need, and your muscles atrophy.
God.
And yeah, it's a problem. And it's taken space medicine, you know, many decades to understand how to mitigate against these effects successfully for long duration living in lower Earth orbit. But it's not very fun to exercise for 2.5 hours every day with
definitely
resistance
not.
Training. So we're trying to think, if you're going to live on Mars,
yeah.
you know, at a third of Earth's gravity, you're going to have to do something to keep your body from falling apart.
Yeah.
Part of that comes from clothes, say. We had a member of the Microanalogs project who designs microgravity wear. Her name is Anna Talvi, and mm-hmm. she's also here, a PhD student at UCL. Funded by the European Space Agency, I believe. These clothes that help protect your clavicles and keep your core intact. But then I suppose other researchers were thinking about, okay, well, how can we make exercise fun that can engage your core, your mm-hmm. legs, your quads, your glutes, your upper body, but also contribute to cardiovascular activity and health, all in one, which is also compact, takes up a very minimal amount of space, but could also engage with
yeah.
different gravitational forms.
Yeah, and you can do sort of different kinds of acrobatics. And
uh-huh.
How did you bring together, can you say a little bit more about how you brought together the ideas and the methods of these different research areas together in the project? And what insights did these multidisciplinary aspects offer for, you know, how did you bring those methods together?
I think the as an anthropologist, my interest in this was promoting the idea of well-being. And as I mentioned earlier, this idea of what do we need not just to survive in these environments, but to thrive. And thrive, it's a funny word because we call it an ethnographic term because it's open to construction. What thriving means to one person is completely different from what thriving might mean to another. But the reason why we think through thriving and well-being was because we didn't want just biologists to come and talk about cardiovascular health. We didn't want just architects to come and tell us about, well, this space is conducive to, you know, sort of life support structures. We didn't want pragmatics. We have pragmatics in the space industry, and they're very good. Space engineering at UCL and abroad has come up with the most extraordinary things. But we wanted something else. We wanted people to think about the condition of being human. And that includes engineering and architecture and molecular biology and cardiovascular health. Yes, but it also includes art and psychiatry.
Oh, yeah. You had architecture, engineering. Yeah, I mean, it was just phenomenal, really. It sounded so exciting. And yeah, I'm kind of jealous, really.
It was great fun. Take part. We had researchers who developed funeral practices.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
in deep space. You know, what to do with a dead body, which sounds a bit, it sounds a bit morbid. But actually, when you're thinking about the limitations of resources, but also how you memorialize something and give respect to kinship. These are questions about how to live well.
Yeah. So that kind of leads me into my next question. So often in multidisciplinary collaborations, you've got varying interests and concerns, priorities between the team members. So can you share something about how you found common ground?
I have to say, I'm hoping I can say this to our credit, and I'm hoping my collaborators agree with me. I found in this particular project, it was easy.
Okay. Great.
I think everybody had a deep curiosity of, okay, well, what might this question look like outside, you know, outside our own discipline? That's not always the case.
No. And do you have any, I mean, that's another question I have. I'm curious to know whether you've experienced any challenges or tensions.
I have.
Yeah.
And I'm thankful that at the moment, at least with my collaborations at UCL, I think people have been very supportive of interdisciplinary research. But when you start working with researchers in industry, sometimes there are challenges, especially within the space industry, with its pragmatism towards engineering and its sort of problem-solving mentality, which has served it very well over the decades. But see a problem, solve it, get it fixed. But as a result, it's very different for people to see outside that box. And they're keen on, you know, supporting social science, I find, many collaborators within the science industries and other social scientists as well. But I think there's often some challenges, communicative challenges. So, and that's not only their fault. It's also the fault of social scientists who have to develop their own capacities and language to speak outside their own discipline.
Yeah.
So we have a responsibility to actually make our work applied. And I think it naturally is, but you have to speak in terms of helping to solve problems. It can't just be academic jargon within your own discipline. And even if you think you're doing that well, once you get into those meeting rooms or start designing projects with people or working on the ground, you find, oh, maybe we're not speaking in a way that's English for people who maybe work outside anthropology. And
so
conversely, maybe they are not speaking in a way that a social scientist can possibly understand.
So there's something there about laying the ground, like taking the time to lay the ground. But how would you, so in that context you just spoke about, if you could go back and do it again, like how might you lay that groundwork to make that process easier in future?
I'm not sure. I think that there is something to be said when you're in your own discipline, you can think about furthering that discipline. It's something that we demand our PhD students constantly think about when they're developing their final arguments and going into Aviva. How have you furthered the discipline? I think when you start approaching other researchers in industry, I think it's okay to have that in your back of your mind as well, but to also think about how can I help people solve problems? How can this research help me help other people? And it can only make your own sort of academic interests better, I think. But if you start from that framework first, rather than just sort of developing theory or developing the discipline.
Yeah, I really like that. I think that's really solid advice. Thank you. And also, I was wondering, actually, in your off-world living research, whether there are ever any clashes between, it's kind of picking up on what you're just saying, the more speculative work that tends to come from design and art and the work of, say, space engineers. So you and a colleague published a paper in 2021 where you explored utopian architectural designs for human on Mars. And there was a bit which made me chuckle where the architects you were following, they presented their work to the space radiation experts. And the reaction of this expert was, these all look great, but you're all going to die. So how do you bring such different areas of expertise together?
I actually think that that just shows the value of, I'm sorry to preach about it, but I think that just shows the value of interdisciplinary research. The architects with whom we worked on this project are, you know, they're amazing thinkers, but they also work within sort of rigid structures and conservative structures of architecture. They're actually quite radical people, but like I said, you can't sometimes see the system from within the system. So they knew this, and to their credit, they held these workshops, that the ones that we focused on in this paper, that they held these sort of expert panels and consultants of multidisciplinary experts to say, hey, we've designed this project for NASA for this, you know, centennial challenge for Martian habitats. Can you tear it to shreds, please? Which isn't a normal thing. You know, it's not common that people do that. And it just so happened they had one of the world's, you know, best space radiation experts who they invited. She's been thinking about this topic for 40 years. And she was able to tell them, your design, which looked like, you know, a Southern California villa. It was beautiful. And some of the renderings even had dartboards, which it looks great because, you know, throwing darts with a third of Earth's gravity, it sounds great fun. But does it work?
So finally, I'm hoping you can offer some advice for social researchers who want to collaborate like you with neuroscientists, architects, cardiovascular specialists, artists, designers, etc. What are the qualities and skills that have helped you move between the different research perspectives that are central to your collaborations?
I think one of the greatest challenges as a social scientist, I say this hesitantly, but as a social scientist, is when you come with other, you start meeting with people from other disciplines and you start talking about anthropology and people say, why does it matter? Like, or what are you talking about? Or why do anthropology? I think have an answer prepared for that. It helps.
I think it helps you as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. So
by being able to explain it to other people, you have to explain it to yourself to explain it to other people, but by being able to explain it to other people, you understand it better yourself.
Yeah, I think we have to drop our ego a little bit, which is often challenging for academics the fields sort of demand that you put up this iron wall, but drop your ego a little bit, listen to other people, and hopefully you're around people who are going to listen to you. It's not always the case, but I think the benefits of doing that, of getting outside your discipline, I think they're pretty radical.
Finally, do you have, drawing on all of those points, great points that you've shared, what would you say your top tip is for sharing with other collaborative social researchers?
Gosh, I don't know. For lack of poetics, I say find your fellow geeks. Find them. I guarantee you, whatever geek means to you, your fellow geeks will exist in every discipline. Find them, and you'll do great.
Oh, that's wonderful. Aaron, thank you for joining us today. It's been really great talking to you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. That was really, genuinely really fun. You've been listening to Together We Create. This episode was presented by me, Lili Golmohammadi, and edited by Keris Bradley. I was joined today by Aaron Parkhurst. If you want to find out more about his research or the podcast series, please follow the links in the description. This podcast is brought to you by the UCL Collaborative Social Science Domain.